This week on Making Contact.
There are two stories that are told, the one that you heard on July 16, 2009, and the one that's true now that we have all the evidence in.
When Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. was arrested on the porch of his own house, according to his longtime friend and lawyer Charles Ogletree, he may have made some mistakes.
I've been teaching for more than 25 years, and I have told my students, don't ever, 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 ever tell the police you're going to file a complaint.
On this edition, Professor Charles Ogletree tells the story of the arrest that led to the infamous beer summit at the White House. There are many lessons to be learned, detailed in Ogletree's book, The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Race, Class, and Crime in America. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
So, two things. First, the title of the book is called The Presumption of Guilt. There are enough lawyers and judges here to know that there is no such thing in law of the presumption of guilt. There's a presumption of innocence, right? But in reality, many people are presumed guilt by their race, their class, their religion, where they dress, what they drive, where they live. And that shouldn't happen. And so the title is turning the concept upside down so that we won't have it. We have to get away from the presumption of guilt, and I'll be talking about that in this case. The second thing is called The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Race, Class, and Crime in America. And I want to talk about how those things all are part of the factors. What happened? Skip Gates and I have known each other for about 20 years. He came to Harvard in 1991. I've been there since 1985 teaching. And a very accomplished individual, not just African-American, but his work is world-renowned for what he's been able to do. And I want to take you back, July 16, 2009, that's when all this happened. How many people remember something about that? All right. So I'm going to try to fill in all the blanks, all the missing parts that you probably don't know. So here's what it's all about. Professor Gates just returned the day before from China. He'd been there visiting the home of Yo-Yo Ma. So he comes home, his driver picks him up at the airport, drives him to his house on Ware Street. He's probably the only African-American living in that neighborhood, I think he is at that time. And what happens is that a driver takes the two pieces of luggage out of the trunk of the limo, puts them on the porch. Gates tries to open the door. It can't open it. It's jammed. It keeps trying to push it. It won't open it. The driver helps him push it. Finally, they push the door, and they get in, but the door is broken. And the driver takes the luggage inside, gets his tip, and drives away. Gates immediately calls the Harvard real estate that owns this house and says, hey, my door is broken. I had to force it open to get in today. I don't want to sleep in the house with the door broken. Send somebody over right away to fix it. And they said, we'll have somebody there in 15 minutes. And he's telling the woman on the phone, Amanda Moore, about what happened and saying, you know, I was in China. Yo-Yo Ma's family had some 13th century documents. It was a phenomenal travel. And then he looks out his door. He's talking on a portable phone. He looks out his door and he sees someone on his porch. He says, wow, you got the repairman here quick. She said, no, President Gates, he's not here yet. It'll take another 10 minutes. And Gates walks from the front of his house to the door, and he sees outside a police officer, uniform, badge, and gun. And Gates is looking and looks out the door, and the officer does this, says, come out, come outside. I want you to come outside right now. He said, what? Come outside. And Gates says, I live here. He says, I want you to come outside. He says, I'm not coming outside. No, I will not. He says, I want you to come outside. He says, I live here. This is my house. He said, show me some identification. Gates says, fine. Gates turns around, goes to his table where his wallet is. He didn't have it on him, and opens it up, and you can see two forms of identification. So the first thing you need to know is that on that date when the officer came in his house, he showed him his Harvard ID. Now, I don't know why he showed him the Harvard ID first, but he did, right? But it has his photograph on it, his name, and his title, Officer, Harvard University, Henry Louis Gates, Jr. Below that is his driver's license. Henry Louis Gates Jr., 17 Ware Street, the address of the house, Cambridge, Massachusetts, with his photograph as well. So the fact of the matter is, one, the officer saw both forms of his identification in his house and knew who he was, number one. Number two, how long do you think it took from the time some woman called and said, I think people are breaking in, and Gates is trying to identify himself, has this argument with the police officer, and then we see him walk, taken out in cuffs? The entire thing took 6 minutes. That's it. And so as a result of that, the case begins. I'm minding my own business on Thursday, July 16th at Harvard. So I'm coming out of the faculty lunch, and I get a call from a very hysterical woman. Her name is Joanne Kendall. She's the former assistant to Professor Gates. I said, calm down, Joanne. So tell me what happened. What actually happened? He was arrested. I said, okay, where did this happen? Where was he arrested? She says, in his house. I said, I'm not asking where he is now. Where was he arrested? In his house. What? He was arrested in his house. I said, wait a minute. All right, let me get out of here, right? I go to the police station where he's being hailed, and this is what the book is about. There are two stories that are told, the one that you heard on July 16, 2009, and the one that's true now that we have all the evidence in. How does this all happen? As Gates is getting out of the limousine, going into his house, there's an elderly white woman across the street, and she says she thinks she sees people breaking into a house. She doesn't have a phone, so she asks what I call the hero, a woman named Lucia Whalen, to call the police. And here's what the eyewitness says when she calls the police. It's in the book, and I put the report in there so you'll know it. She calls the police and says this, I don't know what's happening. I just had an elder woman standing here, and she had noticed two gentlemen trying to get in the house at that number 17 Ware Street. So this is what she said, the eyewitness. I went to the house. I noticed two suitcases. They were there on the porch. And here's what she said. And I'm not sure if these are two individuals who actually work there or live there. Not a single presumption at all about being burglars. I don't know. I don't know if they work there or if they live there. And she said that again on the 911 call. And then the dispatcher says this. Are they black, white, or Hispanic? They can ask that, right? And she says, very important, she says, well, there were two men. One looked kind of Hispanic. I couldn't see the other, right? The only racial description she gave was of a Hispanic person, right? And that they could have been working there or they might have lived there. That's the description she gave on 911, which is her voice, her words, her testimony. What does the officer say? Officer Sergeant Crowley's a white police officer, grew up in Cambridge, went to the same high school that my kids attended, was liked by his coaches, including George Greenwich, an African-American coach, said he was a great wrestler, great football player. He would stand by him, been on the police force for 11 years, worked at the Harvard University police force, but only in the night shift, had never met Gates, and Gates had never met him. So what does Crowley say in his report? He writes his report after Gates is arrested, after he's at the police station, and when he goes back to the station, he writes it that night. And here's what he says in his report. He says, as I reached the door, a female voice called out to me. True. I turned and looked into the direction of the voice and observed a white female, later identified as Whalen, as Lucia Whalen. Whalen, who was standing on the sidewalk in front of the residence, held a wireless telephone, true, in her hand and told me that it was she who had called. True. She went on to tell me that she observed what appeared to be two black males with backpacks on the porch. She never said that, ever, and we have it. And she has brought a claim against the city saying, why did you allow this officer to put this in the report? You've got my voice. I never said black. I never said male, two black males. I never said backpacks. That's the first thing in his report, and that's why lawyers have to pay attention to these things. Then he says he goes into the house, and he gets the identification from Gates, but he says Gates is uncooperative. Why? Because Gates didn't come outside, right? And here's what he puts in his report that's worth noting in terms of his sense of what was going on. He says Gates and he are having a disagreement. Gates is arguing with him. And he finally tells Gates that he's not going to listen to him anymore. Gates is saying all of these things. Gates says, here's my ID, my Harvard ID. Here's my driver's license. And the officer just looks at him. He doesn't say, okay. He doesn't say, I'm still going to arrest you. He says nothing, just looks at him. And Gates says, why are you doing this to me? Do you know who I am? Gates said that. Do you know who you're messing with? Gates said that. And the guy just looked at him and said, are you doing this because I'm a black man and because you're a white police officer? Why are you doing this? No explanation at all. Gates even said, if you don't believe me, call the chief. The chief is Bud Riley, the chief of the Harvard University Police. I know police officers. They know me. Call the chief, right? And so Gates is pleading with him to do something, and nothing happens. Here's what Crowley says in his report about Gates. He says, when Gates asked a third time for my name, because Gates never got his name, Gates kept asking for the name, I explained to him that I had provided at his request two separate times. Gates continued to yell at me. I told Gates that I was leaving his residence and that if he had any other questions regarding the matter, I would speak with him outside of the residence. That's in his report. Now, why outside? Because there's no law that Gates violated in his own house. He can argue with the police officer. You can argue with it. Everything he said was protected by the First Amendment. It may be arrogant, it may be defiant, it may be anger, but it is not a crime. And this is a single house. It's not as if he's disturbing the peace of the neighborhood, right? It's nobody next door, it's nobody upstairs or downstairs, it's Gates and the police officer. And this is two different people in the sense the officer is offended to hear what Gates has to say. And then he says, you know, he goes on to say, well, this is just amazing. He says, my reason for wanting to leave the residence was that Gates was yelling very loud and the acoustics of the kitchen and foyer were making it hard for me to hear. The acoustics were bad. So I'd have to go outside, right? And that's why this report's so important. This would be unbelievable if he had not written it down. It tells you the story, exactly what happened. And so he does go outside and Gates follows him outside and Gates sees the Harvard police and said, hey guys, you know it's me. Tell him this is my house and tell him who I am. And they said, we know Professor Gates, but it's not our case. The Cambridge police were here first. It's their case. And Crowley says, well, Gates is arguing. He's making noise. And this is what Gates said that turned the tide that night, that day. Gates said this. He said, I can't believe you're doing this to me. I'm going to file a complaint against you. And he said, I want your name and I want your badge number. That's what he said. Right to his face, and he has a right to say that. I've been teaching for more than 25 years, and I have told my students, don't ever, 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 ever tell the police you're going to file a complaint. Don't do that. And certainly never ask for his name or his badge number, because look at him or her. It's on their chest. The name's on one side, the badge number's on the other side. Collect that information and use it. You have a right to demand it, but why do that when your consequence is going to be something very unfortunate and maybe unhealthy. And obviously Gates didn't take my class. He didn't know that, but that I'm not mad at him because of that. But the reality is that you have that right, but it doesn't mean you should do it. And this is a classic example of what, how it went wrong. And so the officer says Gates is making noise. The officer says he sees people outside, including police officers. So he places Gates under arrest. Now it's interesting when Gates is in the police car taking the cruiser, he takes his handcuffed hand, pushes the button to let the window down. The last thing he says, Joanne, call Tree. That's me. He didn't have a phone number, didn't have, just call Tree. And that's what she did. And so he was able to get assistance, which is an irony because most people can't do that. That's the class issue. Gates had a lawyer ready when he called, and that made an enormous amount of difference. So what happens? I go to talk to Gates at the jail that afternoon, and I tell him, Skip, this looks like a very bogus arrest. I don't think it's going to stand, but I'm asking you as your lawyer to do one thing. What? I want you to be quiet. I want you to say nothing. I don't want you to talk to anybody. I don't want you to call anybody. I don't want you to have any objection. Why? Because the more you talk, that might change what's in the police report before the ink is dry. And so he said, I will be quiet. And no one in the world except me and Gates and the police knew that he was arrested on Thursday, the 16th of July. There was no news. Or on Friday, or on Saturday, or on Sunday. On Monday, the charges were dismissed. The city apologized to him. And then the word was Gates had been arrested. Everybody knew. But the charges were dismissed, which was great. And I'm thinking, case closed, client happy, let me go back to my summer activities. And then I get a call that day from the New York Times. And I pick up the phone and said, yep, Professor Ogletree, New York Times, do you want to offer any comment on the statement your client, Henry Louis Gates, gave about his arrest? I said, hold on, click, call Skip. Skip, did you talk to the New York Times about your arrest? No, Tree, I just gave them background information, just background information. I said, hold on, right? You can see that's the first mess, right? Background information, whatever that means. And then I'm reading in the newspaper online the next day something called the Daily Beast. There's a hot article that's all over the internet. It says, an interview with my father, the jailbird. The author is Liza Gates, Professor Gates' daughter. I call him, Skip, Did you give your daughter an interview? Hey, Tree, we were just talking, man. Skip, I'm reading page after page. Question, answer, question, answer. You can't do that. If you thinking about a claim, you can't give interviews no matter how frustrated you are. And he says, okay, I won't say anything else. And it was quiet until the next day.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to Harvard professor Charles Ogletree, speaking about his book, The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates, Jr. and Race, Class, and Crime in America.
The next day was pretty remarkable because there was some of you might have seen it, a remarkable press conference in Washington where our president, my mentee, had given a phenomenal discussion about health care, about passing the health care law, and that he had 60 votes. Remember, Ted Kennedy was still a senator, 60 Democrats, who it would cover. It would ensure 15 million people take care of pre-existing illnesses. It was a wonderful press conference. The last question from a Chicago reporter was this: President Obama, do you have any comment on the arrest of Henry Louis Gates, Jr.? And he said, well, first, Professor Gates is my friend. Second, I don't know all the facts. Maybe you stop there, right? Right? But the next thing he says is what I say blackened him. Now, what did he say? He said, the Cambridge police acted stupidly when you arrest a man in his own house after he'd given you identification, right? All the world heard was the Cambridge police acted stupidly. And what that made him was no longer the president of the United States, but the black president. Because all of a sudden he was colored in a sense that the black president defending his black friend from Harvard against this hardworking white police officer, right? And Glenn Beck said that when he heard this, he said, President Obama is a racist and he hates white people. And Glenn Beck was reprimanded by Fox News, but his ratings went up like crazy. It fed into a cavern of interest in trying to figure out exactly what had happened, and people agreed with the sentiments about the president. But the president said a final thing that most of us didn't hear. He said, Lynn, I want to tell you as well that there's been a history of racial profiling of black and Latino men. He said, as a state senator in Illinois, I supported legislation to deal with racial profiling and a disparity between blacks and Latinos and others and being arrested by police. I'm getting calls from African Americans who I know said, man, did you hear that? The president recognized and said we have a racial profiling. So blacks were embracing the president by talking about race in a candid way. Whites were very critical of him of taking the side of his black upper class middle class friend against the hard working class police officer. And it became an issue until the president finally decided, I've got to get this off my table. And what happens next? The beer summit, right? Right? And the beer summit is interesting because the idea was, I've got to get back to health care. I cannot keep having this issue of Gates' arrest dominate the news. And so he invites both Sergeant Crowley and Professor Gates to the White House for beer. They each bring their friends, and they're going to have a beer. This is the kumbaya moment of this whole thing, right? Because you've got two white guys and two black guys sitting around a table in the Rose Garden having a beer. What could be more American than that, right? Yeah, it's all over, right? And we thought it would end then. And so that the dismissal, the apology was the story, but I wanted to use it as a vehicle to talk about the larger problem. This is not just about race, it's about class. Why? When Gates said, do you know who I am? He's saying, I'm not just some black guy that you can come into my house and doubt that I live here. I'm a Harvard professor. I'm a MacArthur genius. I got that award. I've written books. I've done films. I am known. Do you know who you're messing with? I'm a man of distinction. He said all those things. All those things, and defiant about why are you not believing me when I tell you that? And that's part of the class issue that comes through very clearly. I'm sure Sergeant Crowley's saying, who is this? Talking to me like this? Not afraid of me? Well, but he's not realizing Gates is really in his house, and Gates is not tolerating this intolerable circumstance, and he's very angry about it. It also gets into another issue as well when you think about the way all of this happened. It's very significant because Crowley, I met him at the White House, and we talked for a while, and he said that that night after arresting Gates and doing this report, he decided to Google him on the internet. And he went upstairs to his house on a computer and looked at it, and he saw Henry Louis Gates Jr. thing just exploded. He says, oh, shucks, right? He had no idea. He really didn't know what he'd done, but he saw this black man, and that was enough to have doubts about it. What could Crowley have done? Let me just get to the conclusion. What could Crowley have done if he thought Gates was, in fact, the burglar of the house? Arrest him. Sort it out later. Arrest him. If you really think he's the burglar, arrest him. He didn't do that. If you thought maybe he didn't know there are people burglarizing his house, two black males with backpacks, then detain him and search the house. He didn't do that. When Gates says, call the chief, he knows me. He could have called the Harvard University police chief. Do you know this guy? Short, arrogant, loud-talking guy. His name's Henry Louis Gates Jr. Do you know him? That would have resolved it. Or he could have said, you know, we've made a mistake. You didn't break into your house. You're not a burglar, and we're sorry. He didn't do that. He didn't do any of those things. All those options were available. None of those things happened. And that's why this case became the issue it is. The final chapter is called 100 Ways of Looking at a Black Man. Now, that chapter is based on all the calls, faxes, text messages, emails, and letters I got after this from people who were women, men, black, white, every religion, every race, calling or sending information saying it happened to my grandmother, aunt, niece, daughter, uncle, grandfather, nephew, and their stories. But what I found the most amazing aspect of it is that most of the people who wrote me and called me were professional African-American men. And that struck a chord to me. I said, wow, why is it happening that way? Because it happens to a lot of people, and most of the people who have the means they'll complain about it. I just gave a talk with a professional man earlier, and I said, yeah, let me tell you about my case. And the cases are over and over again. It happened to Thurgood Marshall when he was going down south. It happened to John Hope Franklin, a great historian, when he was at a exclusive club where he'd been a president in Washington, D.C. It happened to our Attorney General, Eric Holder. He, after Gates' arrest, he says, I remember when I was in college, the police pulled me over. They wanted to search my car for weapons, and I was embarrassed. I was dispirited. It happened to Vernon Jordan, Spike Lee. You name the list. I recount the stories in the book of people who have had these variety of incidents. And I'll end with just two that sort of struck me. I said in the book that Johnny Cochran made two mistakes. Johnny was a very successful lawyer. You know, he represented Michael Jackson, O.J. Simpson, P. Diddy, Geronimo Pratt, and a lot of other people. But before he was a well-known lawyer in civil and criminal matters, he was a prosecutor. And the two mistakes I say Johnny made is the first mistake Johnny made in the 1980s is that he bought a Rolls Royce, right? All right, that's fine. The second mistake he made is that he drove it on the L.A. highways, right? Right? And so Johnny tells us in his book that he's pulled over by police and they pull guns on him in his Rolls Royce. And he says, put the guns down. I have my two children in the back seat. Here's my driver's license and here's my badge. I'm a district attorney. What did they say to Johnny? Oh, Mr. Cochran, we didn't know it was you. That's about class, right? Black man, Rolls Royce, LA, it has to be stolen. It has to be carjacking. It can't be. But even if they did know it was him, is it okay if Johnny Cochran drives it, but no one else can? That's the class problem, the assumption, the race class conundrum that people have that have to deal with it. And finally, I'll end here. A good friend who's a lawyer in Memphis, Tennessee, is from Alabama. His name is Prince Chambliss. Prince wrote me as well about his own racial profile. It had nothing to do with police. A year ago, he was at his suburban home in Memphis, a very nice house. And he was out one Saturday cutting the grass in his khakis and an old faded sports shirt. An elderly white woman drove by and said, hey, you, How much you charge to cut the grass? And he had a Carl Rowan moment. He says, ma'am, I don't charge anything to cut the grass, but I do sleep with the woman of the house. She hit the gas and drove off as fast as she could, right? The problem with that is that, you know, he didn't say, do you know who I am? Do you know who I'm messing with? I own this house. I live in this neighborhood. He didn't do any of that. The problem is that she drove away thinking that black man wanted to have sex with me just to cut the grass, right? So there was no bridging of the gap. And his point was, you know, I'm not going to waste my time trying to educate her. That would be a waste of my time. But I tell these stories as a reminder of the problems. And I use these 100s, more than 100 black professional men for this reason. Because they're the exception. Because in most of the cases, in almost every single case, none of them filed a lawsuit. None of them challenged the actions of the police. They complain about it now. And if they, with the resources, the ability, the prestige, if they don't do it, what does it say for a young black man without a lawyer, without the ability? A lot of people in the community are furious because they're judged not by what they can do, but by the pants they wear, the hat they have, the shoes they have, where they're traveling. And it's traumatic. And it's not, it doesn't pass. People don't realize the psychological damage it does. It's permanent. And as I say, one of the biggest problems is that a lot of kids run, not because they've done anything, out of fear, I'm going to get beat up or mistreated. And then the police says, aha, if you're running, you must be a criminal. I bet if you talk to any of your 10th, 11th, 12th grade students, they can tell you the 6, 7, or 8 times they've been stopped for nothing. And then they sort of, it becomes, and the police don't think anything about it, it becomes natural, and that's the problem. It's even worse. When I said this in the last book that I wrote, is that how many of us remember when we went to school, all the things we had to go through? We didn't have to go through any security. We didn't go through a metal detector, right? And the whole idea is that school has become like a little prison, and you have to sort of submit to it. Now, you've got safety and all those concerns are very important, but think of what has happened to the condition of a child who every single day has to take every piece of metal off, belt, coins, etc. It becomes, it's not going to the airport, it's you're going to learn. That has to influence what you think about when you get through that metal detector, when you go sit in the classroom, right? Or seeing somebody in uniform, or seeing a sign saying no trespassing. So we have built a community that unfortunately undermines our effort to support what we're trying to do. And so it's a reminder that we have to not just tell our stories, but we have to, in a sense, be the trailblazers. We have to be the pioneers. We have to set the course. And making sure that these injustices are revisited. We can't ignore law enforcement. We can't be subject to it all the time. We have to deal with it and make sure that they're there to protect us when we want them to protect us, but also that they'll leave us alone when our rights give us the rights of privacy. Thank you.
Hit me!
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to Harvard professor Charles Ogletree speaking about his book, The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Race, Class, and Crime in America. He spoke at the African American Art and Culture Complex of San Francisco on October 21st, 2010. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.